Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, political bombshells this week with a big GOP win, a supercharged high court decision, health care action unplugged, and Haiti suffering on. Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown came from far behind to win the late Ted Kennedy's Senate seat and shake up everything on Capitol Hill.
I hope they're paying close attention because tonight the independent voice of Massachusetts has spoken.
In a landmark 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court opened the floodgates for corporate money and political campaigns. Free speech, said the court. New York Democrat Senator Chuck Schumer issued this warning.
The Supreme Court has just predetermined the winners of next November's elections. It won't be Republicans. It won't be Democrats. It'll be corporate America.
And in Haiti, nearly a week and a half after the big quake, aftershocks and relief workers still feeling the pinch. Here's Virginia doctor David Griswell.
We've been here now several days working, and all these medical supplies and other equipment are sitting there at the tarmac of the airport, and they're not moving out. No one's fed these patients now in 4 days.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What does it mean for the high court to greenlight a new wave of corporate money in American politics? Free speech or politicians for sale? How about the GOP's big Senate win, health care now, Haiti? Joining me now from Washington is Jennifer Rubin. She's contributing editor at Commentary Magazine, writes regularly at Commentary's Contentions blog, very regularly. You're a blogging machine, Jennifer. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
It's very nice to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, we're joined by Howard Fineman, senior Washington correspondent and columnist for Newsweek magazine, author of The 13 American Arguments. Howard Fineman, always great to have you. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jennifer, and Howard.
Let's go straight to the Supreme Court's big decision. A couple of views here on tape last night on MSNBC. Florida Democratic Congressman Alan Grayson saying the court's ruling on corporate campaign finance will have dire implications in future elections.
This will lead to a drowning flood of money from corporations in exchange for favors. And it basically institutionalizes and legalizes bribery on the largest scale imaginable. Corporations will now be able to reward the politicians that play ball with them, and they will be able to beat to death the politicians that don't.
Beat to death the politicians that don't. There's Democrat Alan Grayson. Of course, 5-4 decision, abolishing limits on corporate spending in political races. The group responsible for bringing the issue before the court was Citizens United, a conservative advocacy group behind the 08 documentary Hillary the Movie. David Bossie, president of Citizens United, says everyone's voice will now be heard.
Parts of the political spectrum, whether you're to the left, in the center, or to the right, politically speaking, this ruling helps everyone equally. It is the ultimate in a nonpartisan issue.
Howard Fineman, how about it? It's a beautiful world. Everybody can spend. Everybody can speak.
Sure. If you're a Fortune 500 company with a couple billion dollars in profit you want to dip into to spread 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or $100 million around, great. You're even more free. I've read the opinion. I've read the concurrences and the dissents. I'm a reporter and a lawyer, so I certainly believe in free speech. But this, I think, is a travesty. I can't use maybe there's a stronger word. This is something the founding fathers never would have contemplated. We do have limits on speakers. It's not true that we are not allowed to limit speech based on the speaker. We are, and we do constitutionally. We limit government employees' rights to speech. We limit students. We limit police officers. We do have limits, and corporations are not, despite what the Supreme Court said here, they are not people. And if I can give a small plug for my book, the essence of the book was that the key argument in American life is over who is a person. That's what the slavery issue was. That's what the Civil War was. But we have never said that corporations are humans. And that is essentially, that is the basis. That's the philosophical basis for this opinion, and it's outrageous.
Jennifer Rubin, how do you see it? Mitch McConnell, conservative head out of Kentucky, has fought hard for it, welcomed it big time here. Basically, George W. Bush's guys on the court made it happen. Are you applauding, Jennifer?
Well, the justice who made it happen was not George Bush's guy. It was Justice Kennedy, who can hardly be characterized as an ideologue. Let's back up a moment. What is at issue here is the First Amendment. And the ruling takes the position, I think rightly so, that what we're talking about is core political speech. We're not talking about people who are in pseudo-dependent roles, Howard, like students in a high school classroom. We're talking about the essence of the First Amendment. And what the court held was that corporations and labor unions, by the way, we haven't heard the word labor unions. This applies equally to them, and there will be opportunities for them and those voices to be heard as well, have the right to fully participate in the system. I actually think everyone has really missed the boat on this. It is a way of making the system less corrupt. Currently, there is a facade that goes on. Corporations are not allowed to directly give to candidates, but it's funny that Chuck Schumer should be speaking up because he receives hundreds of thousands of dollars directly or to the Senate committee through PACs, which is a very nefarious way by which executives' employees are pressured by corporations to give money. Now corporations can participate in the public system, in the political system. They have to disclose the money, and it's above board. It's out in the open. No wonder Chuck Schumer is so upset.
Do we need more corporate money in our system,
Jennifer? To have their employees give money to him than simply go out and run their own ads and let their voices be heard.
Do you feel a need for more corporate money here?
The solution to speech you don't like is more speech. If people don't like what corporations are saying, then other voices will be heard and let 1,000 voices be heard.
Jack Beatty, how big a deal is this?
Well, it's huge. You know, in 1907, Theodore Roosevelt signed a bill that that essentially stopped corporate contributions directly to candidates. That was in response to, among other things, the election of 1896, which saw the Republicans spending $16 million, most of it from corporate funds, against the Democrats, $400,000. And that has remained. So we've gone back. I mean, it's another example of going back into the past. Our levels of inequality approach the Gilded Age. Countervailing power in the form of unions approaches the Gilded Age, and now we're back to Gilded Age electioneering, in which companies can disperse funds directly from their treasuries and not through the intermediary of PACs. What difference does that make? Well, consider this. Exxon's PAC, I think, contributes something like $1 million a year. Exxon's profits last year were $45 billion. It can now reach into the $45 billion pot to make contributions. You know, free speech is a primary, overriding value of our system, but so is preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption. Justice Stevens, in his dissent, points out that the Founding Fathers were obsessed with corruption. That's what they saw had brought down republics in the past, the great influence of money and power bending the government to the will of the few. And this, of course, just simply allows that to happen with all the breaks that had been put in over a century removed.
Let's hear straight from our listeners.
That's not accurate. They can't use profits to donate directly. That's a misstatement. They can use that money to speak to the public. They are not allowed to make donations directly to candidates.
But straight into ads supporting or opposing, we take that point.
It's called speech out in the marketplace, and other voices can be heard as well. You know, labor unions in the last round of elections in state, local, hard money, soft money, contributed about $1 billion across the country if you add up all the money in all the races. That's a huge countervailing force to corporations.
Well, that countervailing force is about to be obliterated by this decision. I agree with Jennifer that actually unions, if you could quantify all the organizing work and the hours spent in addition to money spent on brochures and proselytizing their own people, unions in many ways have had an advantage in terms of spending, and especially in states with the big cohorts of labor union members in Pennsylvania, New York, California, et cetera. I think that's true. But that mathematics is about to be obliterated by this.
Howard, this is supposed to be a conservative court by a narrow margin. Was this a conservative decision?
Well, I think it makes a mockery of the idea of careful conservative, in the procedural sense, jurisprudence. This is a radical reach in terms of jurisprudential strategy. They basically wiped away a couple of precedents over the last 20, 30 years, saying that they just didn't function properly and that they would create more bad law, so it's time to wipe them out. These are people who, for the most part, like to think of themselves as cautious and like to think of themselves as trying to divine the original intent or meaning of the founders as we put our Constitution together. I don't think there's any way they can justify the extraordinary power that they've given to corporations, which are fictions, which are legal fictions created by legislatures endowed with certain specific rights. They are not people. And I don't think there was a founding father alive at the time who ever would have thought that, would have thought of extending to the few corporations that existed at that point these kinds of powers. So, you know, this is has nothing to do with the original intent of the founders, it seems to me.
Jennifer Rubin, I tried to ask earlier, but do you think we need more money? What surely will be the net result of this in American politics, Jennifer?
I think we don't spend enough on politics. We spend a lot of money on dog food. I love dogs, don't get me wrong. We spend a lot of money on frivolous things. What more important activity could there be than participation in the political process, which we're really talking about here? Now, I would take issue with Howard. I'm also a recovering lawyer, having spent about 25 years practicing. And I think there's a confusion between incrementalism and original legal interpretation. It is not an incremental decision. I'll agree with Howard. They went back and they overruled Austin. They overruled a prior precedent. But it is very conservative if your philosophy is that the meaning of the Constitution has words, has meaning, the plain meaning of the Constitution.
We'll come back and look at those words and their meaning.
And that it is an originalist interpretation of the First Amendment. This is absolutely core speech.
We've got to take a short break here. Jennifer Rubin from Commentary Magazine, please stand by. Howard Fineman with Newsweek, Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a big one, a Supreme Court green light for corporate cash in politics. The Democrats' 60-vote supermajority gone in the Senate. Health care reform may be gone as well. And Haiti suffers. Jennifer Rubin from Commentary Magazine is with us. Howard Fineman from Newsweek. I don't know if Jack Beatty is here. Howard Fineman, in a clip earlier, we heard the guy from Citizens United who brought the case, David Bossie, saying everybody's voice will now be heard. It's the ultimate nonpartisan issue, he called it, opening campaigns to corporate and union money. What about the net effect politically of the court's decision?
Well, if you look on the ground, let's look at the 2010 elections. I don't know how quickly corporations will gear up or want to venture out into this new territory that they have. But to the extent they do, I think for the most part, it'll probably help Republicans. I'm looking at senators running in Democratic senators running in red states. I think they're more endangered. I think some weak Democratic candidates in blue states are more endangered to the extent that they voted for health care reform, or they voted for cap and trade on, or they voted against the banks, or they were seen as anti-business in some way if they have a low rating from the Chamber of Commerce or whomever. Corporations might want to get out and spend. I agree with Jennifer that unions are part of the equation. I don't see this opinion affecting them all that much. I think they're already really out there. They were probably pushing the envelope of the law to begin with. But I think to the extent that corporations decide to get directly into this, then it'll affect things. And also, may I say that the one of the other problems with this whole new regime that we're looking at is that it could eventually make the candidates in the political parties almost incidental to their own campaigns.
What do you mean?
Depending on how much money the corporations want to spend independently to advocate for or against the candidate, that has to be independently done. It can't be done in concert with the candidate. That's still part of the law. So the people with the money will make the decisions. And to the extent that corporations want to spend big from their own treasuries, the corporate boardroom and corporate decision-making will become the cockpit of politics. Because, as they said in Watergate, follow the money, and that's where the money's going to be.
Jennifer, what if a corporation's interests and the national interests don't line up, but they've got this great big megaphone, as deep as whatever their treasury is, versus, you know, the little individual megaphones of individual citizens? Isn't there a potential problem here? If politicians are afraid to vote against corporate interests that can come in with so much heavy money against them?
Well, again, I think neither corporations nor unions nor any other sliver of American life are coterminous with the public interest. We have a multiplicity of voices.
What about citizens? What about individual citizens? They don't have a treasury to dip into of that size,
well,
most of them.
Well, I think we showed the power in 2008 of individual citizens organizing, of small campaign donations, which are still the majority of money given. So I think it is up, number one, there are disclosure laws, so candidates can make some head of this. And secondly, that, again, the answer to speech that you don't like is more speeches to involve more. I would caution my friends on the right, however, I'll take a little bit of exception with what Howard said, although I agree, I think there's going to be more caution than we suspect from corporations, which are naturally cautious people, contrary to perhaps the popular belief. Corporations have gotten very used to giving to both sides, covering their bets on the table. We saw this in 2008, where they gave very heavily to Barack Obama's campaign. That may change now that they've seen a little bit of the agenda. But I think, number one, they're going to be a little bit restrained the first time out of the box. Number two, you're going to see them giving to people on both sides of the equation. I would also suggest that although many of the trends that Howard picked up on may be exacerbated by this decision, in other words, votes against business interests or votes against in favor of cap and trade may be harmful, those were problems for these candidates long before that. And we have seen that red state senators, blue dog Democrats, are polling rather poorly already with just ordinary voters. So I think the substantive issues that have put these people at risk will remain. If corporations choose to pile into the pool, as it were, that may translate into a lot of ads. Mm-hmm. I don't agree, however, that campaigns are going to be run by corporate boardrooms. We already have independent third-party ads. They have to disclose it. The disclosure requirements remain in place. Candidates do remain, for a variety of reasons, including free media, the central focus of their campaign. So I don't think we should necessarily overstate the impact of this.
But, Jack, now this money can roll in, and it can roll in right up to the end of the campaign, disclosure or not. There wouldn't be much time to respond if it comes in very late. I mean, I keep thinking of the individual congressman or woman or senator who's looking at a particular vote. They know there's a corporate interest who knows they're sitting there thinking on that vote that can come in with them, on them with millions. Jennifer's right. There's plenty of corporate money out there already, but now, I mean, the tidal wave can come down on their head if they vote against a particular interest.
Absolutely, and they know it. And meanwhile, the public doesn't know it. The disclosure comes late. It's not known by many people. I mean, who knows who gives to whom? I mean, that's all buried in the records. So that's a kind of figment defense that, you know, that somehow disclosure prevents abuses. John McCain, I think, put it very well when he said that this, you know, Justice Kennedy said, independent expenditures by corporations, quote, do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. John McCain put it very well. He said that displays extreme naivete about the role of money in politics. You don't have to give directly to a candidate to help the candidate. And it's that almost innocence that seems to, about the way politics really works, that colors this decision. And you raise the question, Tom, about political voice. We have a crisis of political voice in this country. The individual, you know, the people that change the bedpans and clean the floors are not heard in Congress, and yet they make up the working poor, make up 30-40% of the population. They're
never mind, the middle
heard.
Class is saying right now,
yeah,
it's
right.
Not heard.
Nobody is heard. And we just had an election in Massachusetts where there was essentially people saying, you're not listening to us. This is going to drown out the voices of the ordinary person even more.
Jack, got to get to listeners.
If I may,
Howard, let me get
sure.
a couple of calls, and then we will. Maggie, Des Moines, Iowa. Maggie, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm so glad you're covering this. But I think that the very basic thing needs to be covered much more strongly, and that is that why are corporations considered persons? How do they get to become persons? Well, and if you study the Constitution, you know that they are not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution. In fact, the Founding Fathers tried to hold back the power of corporations. As the corporations became more powerful during the Civil War, with the profits that are automatically made by corporations during war, they decided they wanted to have even more power and were constantly going before the Supreme Court with cases trying to become declared persons.
As if persons. Maggie, we've got it. The question stands right there. And we've got also Mark calling on the same subject. Mark, Acton, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Mark.
Hi, Tom. You know, this is not some abstract legal argument here. These five members of the Supreme Court, and Jennifer Rubin, I'm afraid, also, seems to have a hard time distinguishing between flesh and blood people and the corporate personhood. And let me put it to you plainly. The difference is this. If you tickle them, they do not laugh. If you prick them, they do not bleed. And my point is that corporations, if they get this unlimited political power, are going to be able to have representatives vote to send people to war, to bleed and die for their causes. They're going to be able to deny them health care. They're going to bleed and die as a result of this decision. And I don't want to hear about imposing on their, infringing on their First Amendment rights, because there isn't a corporation out there that doesn't have a shareholder who has an individual First Amendment right. He can speak all he wants. The only thing that they're accomplishing with this fiction is to elevate the power of those individuals with money to have a greater voice than those people without.
Mark, we've got it. And let me get one more. Fishersville, Virginia. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am an attorney. I retired from the Virginia Attorney General's office. Mm-hmm. I want to echo some a remark that I heard earlier, but I want to add this point. Voting is the most fundamental right of every individual in this country. Mm. Corporations act, and they only act through individuals, but they don't act as individuals. And I think that is the fundamental, thinly veiled flaw of Kennedy's decision, because he treats in this decision, essentially, a corporation as an individual. When he bases the right to contribute as a fundamental right, as a freedom of expression. But I distinguish clearly the right to vote of an individual from a corporation acting through individuals and not as an individual.
Jim, we've got it. They don't vote, but they can surely, as others, influence votes. Let me go to my panel. Howard, I had to interrupt you there to get the folks in, but you hear the first concern that's coming up.
Yeah, I do. And I went to the rehearing. In other words, I went to the oral argument, the second oral argument mm-hmm. that they had in the fall, partly because it was Sonia Sotomayor's first appearance, and it's a big case. I was curious, and I'd rarely do it, but I did it. And what impressed me was the passion that John Roberts, the Chief Justice, had on this point. I mean, he actually was red-faced, almost veins bulging, as he questioned the government lawyers trying to defend the regulatory scheme.
And passion in what direction? For or about what, Howard?
Well, he hated the idea of the micromanagement of speech that the government had been forced into defending as part of the McCain-Feingold scheme. And I sympathize with that. Mm-hmm. In other words, I think... It's hard, it's complicated, and it has certain Orwellian overtones
yes.
to it that are indeed disturbing. And I get that. Nobody wants government bureaucrats deciding what video gets to play on what DVD screen or what cable channel, which is what the facts were in this case. But my point is I think they went way too far in trying to make sure that there wasn't a government bureaucracy to regulate political speech. Nobody wants that. Nobody in this country wants that. But that wasn't what was at issue in the facts of this case. They went way beyond the facts of the case. Part of the reason for having the rehearing was so they could get to this broader philosophical question of personhood and regulation, et cetera. I think they way, way overdid it. And it raises a host of problems that we're going to be dealing with in the future.
Jennifer, you hear our callers saying they don't want to give the rights of individuals, of actual citizens, voters, to corporations.
Well, if we talk about respect for precedent, this is a long-standing precedent in terms of personhood and issues, and it gets a bit dry, but I would commend the listeners to read Justice Scalia's concurrence. You know, Howard, it's interesting. I think where this case was lost for those who favored McCain-Feingold was in an exchange in which the FEC lawyer was asked if there was a book published, 200 pages, 500 pages, and the last line was, and go vote for so-and-so. Would that be subject to this requirement and therefore be banned? Would the book be banned? And not realizing the quicksand he was stepping into, the FEC lawyer said, sure. And I think that's where the case was lost. The justices then probed, you mean Kindle would be covered as well, showing that at least our justices are familiar with Kindle. They said, well, yes. And I think that's the point at which there was an aha moment on the court. And again, this was where everyone is playing for Justice Kennedy's vote here. This is not a man who is known for his ideological extremism, although I do admire a justice who's going to get hot and bothered by the First Amendment. It seems like a good thing to get hot and bothered by. So I think it is not that there was an overstepping by the court here. I think that the law itself and the natural implications of it are shocking at some level. Now, could the government have done a better job making their case? Would that have been a point that they retreated on? I sure think they think so in retrospect, I'll tell you. But I just do want to correct one thing, Jack. You keep making the same confusion. The requirements that survive are both the disclosure laws, the rules, and the disclaimer laws. People will know which ads are given by corporations. Those remain in place. So you don't have to wait until the quarterly reports come out. They will know in real time. There's no hiding the ball here. People will know what is corporate giving and what is not. And the other candidates can make hay of that if they think that that's a winning point with the voters.
Jack, I've heard you waiting there. Well, we've got other news in this week, but take another swing, Jack.
Well, I was just going to speak to the first caller's question about when corporations and how corporations became persons. I actually wrote a chapter about this in my book about the Gilded Age. Mm-hmm. It was in 1886 in the Santa Clara case, and that case is notorious for having been decided by what one scholar called a fluke. That is to say, the idea that corporations were persons under the 14th Amendment was not, in fact, decided by the facts of that case, which referred to something else, but was, in fact, a kind of dictum put into the reporter's notes, which sort of summarized the case going into, you know, like the syllabus. It has stood as a precedent, even though it had this fluky origin. And the great irony, of course, is the 14th Amendment was passed to protect the rights of African Americans after the Civil War. And in the first 50 years, it was used, I think Justice Douglas said something like 2% of cases were brought to defend them, and over 50% of cases were brought to defend corporations from state laws regulating hours, women's work, and so on. A complete inversion of the amendment.
One more call here. Brian, Hamden, Connecticut. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Actually, it's funny. I'm an early American historian, and I've got to say that the amazing thing about Scalia's concurrence is how tone-deaf it is to the history here. It doesn't make any difference, any distinction between for-profit, non-profits, and civic associations. In one breath, he kind of you would think that the founding fathers couldn't understand the difference between something like the Sons of Liberty and the East India Company.
And you think they just might have?
Clearly they were concerned about concentrations of capital, concentrations of power, and this decision really flies in the face of that.
Brian, thanks for your call. One more, Tuskegee, Alabama. Connie, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I think the outcome, at least in the medium range future, may not be that different, because the big companies, in particular we'll say the health insurance companies, ironically they might be reluctant to be so forthcoming about their full support of blocking health care reform.
Less camouflage.
Yeah. However, my second point is that I think that what this really comes down to, and the real source of alarm here, is the issue of activist judges. And it's kind of a second irony. Read Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker and his books. Our Chief Justice went after this case. He sought it out, and he found it, and he put it forth.
Mm-hmm.
It's ironic to me that the right criticizes so much the supposed activism of the more liberal judges.
It can look like we've got it in our lap right now, right here. Connie and Tuskegee, thank you very much for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, heavy rains, havoc, and mudslide threat in California. Evacuation orders meeting resistance there. L.A. Police Chief Charlie Beck told residents of La Cañada to leave.
We're not doing it because we think your lawn's going to get dirty. We're not doing it because your carpet's going to get wet. We're doing it because your life is at risk.
$45 million buys Conan O'Brien out of The Tonight Show, wisecracking all the way to the bank.
NBC and I have finally reached a separation agreement. That is true. Yeah. No, I knew it was official this morning when NBC dropped off all my CDs and picked up its lava lamp.
And best-selling mystery writer Robert B. Parker, creator of the tough Man of Parts, Boston Detective Spencer, dead at 77. I spoke with Robert Parker in 2006. He talked about his creation.
Spencer was doing something, and an event takes place, and it reminds him of a literary allusion. He makes it. I don't look them up. I don't have a list of them. He is, like the rest of us, all one person with many parts.
You can hear my hour-long interview with Robert B. Parker, dead this week, at our website, onpointradio.org. Jennifer Rubin of Commentary Magazine joins us this hour. Howard Fineman of Newsweek and our own Jack Beatty. We're looking at the Supreme Court's big decision on campaign contributions, on the Democrats' 60-vote supermajority out the window, health care reform in trouble. Let's go to Suzanne in New York, Wingdale, New York. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that I thought that it was a mistake for the campaign to bring the Brown campaign to bring Obama and Clinton and these supposed big guns into Massachusetts.
Or you mean the Coakley Democrats campaign in the final days of her contest with Scott Brown,
right.
The Republican?
I thought
yes.
It made them really look pathetic, and that they were. I thought it iced the fact that they were going to lose because it gave so much national attention. Maybe they should have sent their powers, but not themselves, because. You know, it just made it like a more of a dare, for people to defeat them. If people are voting against the powers that be, then don't bring the powers that be there.
the president came, the former president came, and still Republican Scott Brown came from far behind to take the seat that had been Democrat Ted Kennedy's for nearly half a century. Here he is on Tuesday night after winning that election seat, beating his competitor, Attorney General Martha Coakley, 52-47%.
I will remember that while the honor is mine, this Senate seat belongs to no one person, no one political party. And as I said before, and you've heard it today, and you'll hear it loud and clear, this is the people's seat.
Hooray, said the crowd. And here's the president speaking with George Stephanopoulos on ABC, reflecting on the meaning of Scott Brown's win the previous night and how it came after his first year in office.
One thing that I regret this year is that we were so busy just getting stuff done and dealing with the immediate crises that were in front of us that I think we lost some of that sense of speaking directly to the American people about what their core values are.
President Obama on the loss of the 60th vote for Democrats in the Senate. Howard Fineman, how do you see the fallout from this big, big vote?
It's hard to overstate its importance. I know some Democrats would like to explain it away by Martha Coakley's incompetence, and they would like to talk about the fact that there is already a health care plan in Massachusetts and yada, yada, yada. It's hard to overstate how important this is. It's not only a canary in the coal mine for the Democrats, it's like a giant condor in the coal mine for the Democrats. It's big. It's big, and I agree with the caller, who definitely has a future in political consulting. When they came in at the end and said, when Obama came in and said, do this for me, do this to save health care, it was to protest against his health care plan in good measure and his approach to government and leadership in good measure that all those people were turning out in Massachusetts to vote for Scott Brown, the guy in the pickup truck who seemed to be more the representative of the people and their real lives and their anger than the president of the United States.
Jennifer, listen with us, if you would, to House Republican Whip Eric Cantor out of Virginia, talking with CNN on Wednesday, the day after. He said Scott Brown's win was a bellwether for things to come and that winning a Republican majority in the House come November was a very real possibility here.
I believe that we can take back the majority. We obviously have the wind behind us right now, but the people are looking to us to see what we're about, what our solutions are, how it differs as far as a vision for how we take this country, and in fact to see whether it is we can provide the type of leadership that the voters decided that Senator-elect Brown can provide and Governor McDonnell as well as Christie.
Talking about governors there in New Jersey and in Virginia, Jennifer, what did you see in the outcome? How do you see the fallout coming?
I agree entirely with Howard, and I wonder if still the White House hasn't quite comprehended what occurred and what Howard and I and many others have seen. It was a protest vote. After all, Scott Brown ran as the 41st vote against health care. And yet the president has sort of fobbed this off. Oh, well, it's because I was working so hard for the American people that I didn't connect with them. Or it's because of some inchoate anger that's floating around there. So you wonder how seriously they have taken this to heart. Now, no one expects the president of the United States to come out and do a complete mea culpa on the air. But you wonder if in the White House they are seriously rethinking their priorities, whether they are thinking about perhaps some personnel changes that might reflect those new priorities, and whether they really do get it or not. Now, I think to some extent those decisions are going to be made for them. What we've seen in the last 24, 48 hours has been essentially a just decimation of support for Obamacare, whether it's the Senate version. I use that generically, not in a disparaging way, but to describe sort of all the various incarnations. There aren't votes for the Senate version in the House. There's no stomach to sort of pushing this through on the Senate side. Maybe they'll break it up in little itty-bitty pieces and keep this going for months. No one wants to do that. I just don't see that there are votes in the Congress or any desire to keep at this. So even if the president has not given up, I think some of this decision-making process is going to be made for him. And then the question becomes, can he, like Bill Clinton, who had to take a drubbing in 1994, reset his presidency? Bill Clinton put health care aside, and he passed welfare reform. He did it. He vetoed it a couple times. He didn't get a bill that he liked until the end, but he did that, and he recalibrated his presidency in a very meaningful way and went on to get a second term. Is Barack Obama capable of that same intellectual and personal flexibility? We don't know. It doesn't sound like, but, you know, it's only been 24, 48 hours, and he's just gotten terrible political beating.
And if he does reset, what direction would he reset? Here's a morning after comment from the floor of the Senate by John McCain, welcoming Scott Brown's win.
Last night, a shot was fired around this nation. A shot was fired saying, no more business as usual in Washington, D.C. Stop this unsavory sausage-making process called health care reform, where special favors are dispensed to special people for special reasons in order to purchase votes.
Jack Beatty, Ted Kennedy's seat, now a Republican seat in the U.S. Senate. He, having only passed last August, kind of unbelievable, especially where the polls were only weeks ago. But it's a very big, real fact in Washington.
If you had said this a month ago, no one would have believed it. You would have been laughed out of court. I agree with much of what's been said, but I do want to emphasize the local factors here. I mean, this was in some ways a victory for Democrats, small d, against an ossified, corrupt Massachusetts Democratic political establishment, of which Martha Coakley was the perfect embodiment, a candidate who ran a campaign of entitlement. She campaigned, according to Politico, made 19 public appearances over the same period Scott Brown made 66. She failed in the elementary task of asking people for their vote. She assumed they would vote for her. And she had no political talent. He has beaucoup political talent. He's charismatic. He has the right image.
Looks good naked.
I'm sorry?
Looks good naked at the Cosmo magazine.
Yeah, looks great naked, right. A young man I know who voted for him, also voted for Obama, said he voted for Brown because Brown seemed more like a leader. And indeed, he did. And finally, the Republicans, who in an earlier campaign in New York State had trouble getting their message aligned with that of the Tea Party, the two of them worked in perfect tandem here. And I think that Democrats have got to take that on board. That's a lesson of how the Republicans can pick up this grassroots / astroturf enthusiasm for on the Tea Party side and run it toward their candidates. They did it in Massachusetts, and I suppose they're feeling now, if you can do it in Massachusetts, you can do it anywhere. But the local factors can't be missed here.
Let's hear from Phil in Iowa City. Hi, Phil, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just contrary to what the individual just said, this is a boon to Republicans or Democrats. I'm an independent. I think it's a boon to independents because it shows what I believed in all along, that a pure Democratic Party can't elect a Democrat. A pure Republican Party cannot elect a Republican. Without the independent votes and an appeal to moderation and an appeal to something that he's into an independent, nobody can elect anybody.
Yeah, you're onto something big there. Scott Brown used the word independent more than any other word I can recall. But Howard Fineman, is this an independent who's taking this 41st seat in the Senate?
Well, his initial comments after being elected would lead you to think that he wants to. He portrayed himself as a problem solver. He said some kind of health care for all is a good idea. It's just a question of how you do it. He seemed to be really trying to position himself post-election, post-Tea Party, if you will, as a moderate, problem-solving Republican who could appeal to independents. Now, in Massachusetts, unaffiliated, in other words, about half the voters there are not registered as members of a political party. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they aren't influenced by political parties and their agenda, but they choose to call themselves independents. It's a big factor. It was a big factor in Barack Obama winning the presidency. The exit polls showed that he got 52% of people who described themselves as independents, and about a third of the electorate did so. Now, Barack Obama's down to 41% in those same polls among independents. He's lost a key constituency, in part because of what John McCain said. However worthy the aims of the health care bill are or were, the process of doing it, the way Obama handed it over to Congress, the way special deals were done, the way it dragged out for months and months, the way it got more complicated, less clear in its methods and its goals, really hurt. I think if the president is going to look back at his first year, his big mistake, I think, will be health care. Not so much proposing a health care as an objective, but the way he let the Congress take the lead on it, it resulted in something the American people couldn't stand watching. I agree with McCain on that. And the net result is he may end up with nothing.
Is it dead, Howard?
I think so. I think the idea of a whole comprehensive bill is dead. And the problem with it from the beginning was that it was not radical enough. And it turned into a giant hodgepodge of things that nobody could really understand. However, within it, there are still very good and important measures that would regulate the rest of the insurance industry in the way it isn't regulated now, that would ban companies from denying people coverage for pre-existing conditions, would ban companies from dumping people when they start actually getting sick, things that would try to control costs in better ways, things that might be able to extend care through Medicaid, perhaps, to some other people, but wouldn't be the humongous mess that the whole health care bill turned out to be. Those, I think, could pass, but I think the Congress itself is exhausted from having spent the better part of a year on health care.
Let's go to Sean in Newport, Vermont. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm originally from Massachusetts, and I've always been proud until now to say that, but I think it's just the cruelest irony that Ted Kennedy's flagship issue was health care, and that's going to be scuttled by his replacement. I'm a little aggravated with the Massachusetts Democrats that they couldn't win one for Ted after all he had done for the state. And I just think it's doubly ironic that Mitt Romney was up there, the only governor who signed in mandatory health care requirement for any state in the union, and he would deny that to the rest of us. I think it's cruel irony all around.
Sean, we've got it. Jack, I want to listen to a little tape of Barack Obama after that vote, proposing new banking regulation to limit the scope and size of large financial institutions. Wonder if you think this was a response to the vote in Massachusetts. He fighting words here. He said the old way of doing things on Wall Street just doesn't work anymore.
If these folks want a fight, it's a fight I'm ready to have. And my resolve is only strengthened when I see a return to old practices at some of the very firms fighting reform. When I see soaring profits and obscene bonuses at some of the very firms claiming that they can't lend more to small businesses, they can't keep credit card rates low, they can't pay a fee to refund taxpayers for the bailout without passing on the cost to shareholders or customers, that's the claims they're making. It's exactly this kind of irresponsibility that makes clear reform is necessary.
Jack, I'm watching the clock, and we've got Haiti looming over everything here. But if Barack Obama is going to reset, what does a statement like this say about what direction he may be resetting? Toward the center or not?
I certainly rhetorically a populist reset. You know, majority of Obama voters in the exit polls in Massachusetts said that he was paying more attention to Wall Street than Main Street. That is deadly, and it's in fact been the case. He's trying now to distance himself. Paul Volcker was beside him. Volcker has been the proponent of, you know, even breaking up some of these big companies. Our friend Simon Johnson, the economist, is very pleased with this tougher line. He says, finally, Volcker is in, and Summers, Geithner are in the shade. And that's, I think, all to the good politically. The president has been extremely patient and extremely accommodating to Wall Street. And we saw there the bankers last week before Congress and using, you know, natural metaphors like hurricanes and so on to describe what happened and to absolve themselves of personal responsibility. It was a spectacle for the ages.
Jennifer Rubin, our time is so short, but look south with us for a moment here. Haiti, the images and the news all week long. Aid seems to be slow in getting there. Many more U.S. troops there now, 16,000 by the end of this week. What do you see at this point unfolding in Haiti, Jennifer?
Well, it is a tragedy of enormous proportions, almost unbelievable proportions. And I think it points out a couple things. One, that when there is a crisis in the world, the United States still counts more than any other country in the world. People talk about the multilateral nature of the world, and it's true to a certain extent, but really when the chips are down, America has to be there. And secondly, our army is not big enough. Our military is not big enough. We clearly have roles well beyond fighting forces in humanitarian aid and other areas. And I think this shows what an essential force for good in the world the United States is, and the United States military is, and we should expand it if necessary, which I think we do, and give it the credit that it deserves.
Howard, in a word, is the White House avoiding the Obama's Katrina label here, or do we know yet?
In a word, they've avoided it so far. Much different situation from Katrina, but the story is not finished.
Well, our thoughts and our contributions from right across this country very much with Haiti this week, very much in our mind, and we will pay much more attention to it in the days and weeks ahead. Howard Fineman at Newsweek magazine, it is always great to have you, author of the 13 American Arguments. Thanks for being here today, Howard.
Thank you, thank you.
And Jennifer Rubin at Commentary, thanks so much for joining us, Jennifer.
It was a pleasure.
Jack Beatty, good to have you. Have a great weekend. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.